you very much, James. And I want to echo Mark in thanking James O'Brien for organizing this wonderful program and this magnificent exhibit, and to thank the Chautauqua County Historical Society again for preserving and organizing Tourget's papers, and to thank the Jackson Center for giving us this great venue and this nice connection between Tourget's work and Justice Jackson's work. I am terribly beaten. There is no redeeming feature in the whole matter. I think every county has gone against me. I can see nothing before me now but the most pinching and hopeless poverty. All is a black, dull night. I have ended a life of bright promise in utter ruin. I am dead politically and can have no more place in public life. So wrote Albion W. Tourget after his crushing defeat in the election of 1878, when he ran for a congressional seat as the Republican representative of his adopted home district centering around Greensboro, North Carolina. The tidal wave of reaction that destroyed Tourget's political career also swept away almost everything for which he had been fighting since his arrival in Greensboro in October 1865. As a Union soldier during the Civil War, Tourget had dedicated himself to bringing about a fundamental, thorough, and complete revolution and renovation of American society, one that would transform a nation built on slavery into a republic built on equal justice for all citizens, whatever their race or class. Like many of the white Northerners derisively called carpetbaggers, he had gone south to fulfill this ideal by participating in the Reconstruction Program, through which radical Republicans sought to eliminate the vestiges of slavery and institute genuine democracy in the former Confederate states. During his 14 years in North Carolina, Tourget had played a key role in writing a new state constitution that provided for local self-government rather than rule by an autocratic elite. In addition, he had forged an effective coalition uniting blacks, poor whites, and upper-class converts to radical republicanism, served for 6 years as a Superior Court judge, and waged a heroic struggle against the Ku Klux Klan. By the time Tourget underwent his humiliating rejection by North Carolina voters in 1878, however, Klan violence had overthrown Reconstruction, not only in North Carolina, where Tourget had lost his judgeship in 1874, but throughout the South. The Northern public and press had succumbed to the Southern propaganda campaign against Reconstruction. Democrats, then backers of white supremacy, had recaptured the U.S. House of Representatives, and a Republican president who owed his election to a panel of judges and a secret deal had initiated a let-alone policy that restored the former slaveholding class to power. It was at this juncture that Tourget found a new vocation in the depths of his despair. If he could no longer act in the political or judicial sphere, he could influence public opinion through literature and thus, perhaps, reverse the nation's catastrophic course. Tossing and turning during a sleepless night, Tourget arrived at a sudden inspiration which he awakened his wife to announce. "I am going to write a book and call it A Fool's Errand." He immediately rose and wrote 4 chapters. He continued to work on the novel in spare moments over the next 18 months, but finished it only after leaving North Carolina in August 1879. A Fool's Errand tells the story of a man much like Tourget himself. Its hero, Comfort Servoz, whom Tourget ironically calls the Fool, shares his creator's Huguenot and Yankee roots and follows a similar path. He, too, suffers from wounds inflicted during his Civil War service in the Union Army and goes south to benefit from a warmer climate and to infuse the region's backward economy with free labor principles. And he, too, quickly finds himself ostracized by his neighbors for associating with nigger teachers, conducting a Sabbath school for colored people, and selling land to the freedmen. Initially less politicized than Tourget, the Fool becomes gradually radicalized by his exposure to Southern intolerance. a fictional strategy Tourget adopts to win over readers blinded by distorted accounts of Reconstruction. A political meeting fittingly completes the fool's radicalization as his neighbors force him to articulate his personal views, identical with those Tourget had publicly promulgated, and then try to bloody him on his way home. Thereafter, the fool, like Tourget, becomes a marked man in the community, a butt of abuse in the local newspaper, the recipient of threatening letters, some of which you see on display back there. And once he joins the Union League and is elected to the Constitutional Convention, a target of the Ku Klux Klan. A Fool's Errand devotes 13 chapters to the Klan. Drawn from Tourget's voluminous files of complaints brought before him as a judge, they overwhelm the reader by sheer accumulation. As if amassing evidence in the courtroom, Tourget summons an array of witnesses brutalized by the masked marauders. The parade of grisly testimony climaxes with the murder of a poor white radical and the lynching of a Black Union League leader, modeled on the fates of Tourget's political allies, John W. Stevens and Wyatt Outlaw. A Fool's Errand provides not only graphic eyewitness account of the terrorism that overthrew Reconstruction, but a postmortem of the disaster. It is Northern Republicans who turned Reconstruction into a fool's errand, he stresses, not the idealistic fools who dedicated their lives to implementing the radicals' program of racial equality. The party's cowardly, vacillating, and inconsistent policy unleashed the Klan, and Republican leaders' cowardly shirking of responsibility and snuffling whine about peace and conciliation allowed it to triumph. Tourget documents his charges with fictionalized versions of his exchanges with the Northern politicians he sarcastically calls the wise men. Cementing his case, a chilling letter from one of the wise men responds to the fool's plea for decisive action against the Klan by arguing that the Constitution does not authorize the federal government to interfere in the internal affairs of the Southern states. Quote, if the colored people and the Union men of the South expect to receive the approval, respect, and moral support of the country, they must show themselves capable of self-government, able to take care of themselves. The government has done all it can be expected to do, all it had power to do, in fact. It has given the colored man the ballot, armed him with the weapon of the free man, and now he must show himself worthy to use it, end quote. Only one remedy remains, concludes Tourget at the end of the novel. Quote, let the nation educate the colored man and the poor white man because the nation held them in bondage and is responsible for their education. Educate the voter because the nation cannot afford that he should be ignorant. Published anonymously in 1879, A Fool's Errand caused a sensation. It sold so fast that bookstores could not keep up with the demand, exceeding 5,000 copies in the first 6 weeks and nearly 150,000 before the year was out. Domestic sales would reputedly reach the high watermark of 600,000 in Tourget's lifetime, and translations into German, French, Italian, Swedish, and Russian would extend its fame beyond U.S. borders. Reviewers widely hailed A Fool's Errand as the new Uncle Tom, predicting that it would prove as serviceable in enlightening the North about the startling events of the Reconstruction period as Stowe's masterpiece had in exposing the evils of slavery. Even in North Carolina, Oregon recognized the power of a novel destined, we fear, to do as much harm in the world as Uncle Tom's Cabin. Tourget must have been especially gratified by the reviews that urged statesmen to heed his message. Quote, if every representative and senator in Congress, if the governors and state officers of every state in the Union could read this volume, proclaimed one newspaper, we should be nearer a solution of the problem of Reconstruction, end quote. Eager to capitalize on the success of A Fool's Errand, Tourget's publishers persuaded him to drop his anonymity and furnish a fictional sequel to his bestseller. The result was Bricks Without Straw, published on the eve of the 1880 election, which it did as much as A Fool's Errand to swing to the Republicans. Bricks Without Straw cries out to be rediscovered as one of the most powerful race novels ever written by a white American. That is why I have prepared a new edition of it, forthcoming in a few months from Duke University Press, and why I will devote the bulk of my talk today to persuading you to read it. Unjustly overshadowed by A Fool's Errand, Tourget's second novel about Reconstruction, in fact, surpasses its predecessor both conceptually and artistically. Conceptually, Bricks Without Straw accomplishes the rare feat of envisioning Reconstruction from the Black community's standpoint, a more ambitious undertaking than fictionalizing an author's own experience. Artistically better constructed than A Fool's Errand, Bricks Without Straw features an array of complex, fully rounded characters, a plot that successfully integrates the political action centered on African Americans with the love story centered on whites, a sophisticated narrative technique that relies on flashbacks rather than on linear progression, a self-conscious use of dialogue and dialect to give voice to the voiceless, and an experimental open ending that calls attention to the problems history has left unresolved. The literary achievement modern readers will prize most highly in Bricks Without Straw is its revolutionary approach to depicting African Americans, the product of Tourget's extensive political interactions with them. Casting off the blinders that so drastically limited white perceptions of African Americans, Tourget defies conventions of racial stereotyping ubiquitous in the writings of his predecessors and contemporaries, who either embraced these conventions uncritically or resorted to covert strategies for undermining them. No other white writer of Tourget's time, and few since then, portrayed African Americans with such realism, treated them as independent political agents instead of as menials attached to whites, and accorded them dominant roles in the plot. Complementing A Fool's Errand, Bricks Without Straw shifts the focus from Tourget's autobiographical persona to the freed people, whose story he had subordinated to his own in the earlier work, elevating them from minor characters into central protagonists, and implicitly answering the wise man in A Fool's Errand who had questioned the capacity of the colored people for self-government, Tourget's second Reconstruction novel portrays the newly emancipated slaves not as pitiful victims of white violence, but as active agents in a struggle for self-determination. Bricks Without Straw consequently restricts the Klan to a single, albeit devastating, episode in his dramatization of Black Reconstruction. Tourget explains the title in a satiric preface that purports to be a translation from an ancient Egyptian papyrus. Paralleling the Bible's Exodus story, it tells of how Pharaoh commands the laborers he holds in bondage to make bricks with stubble gathered from the fields instead of straw furnished by the taskmaster. Pharaoh wants to build a palace that will advertise his glory to the world, but he wants his laborers to do it overnight without the necessary materials, just as the American nation wants the newly freed slaves to uplift themselves overnight by their own unaided efforts. Speaking through the king's jester, Neon Kapos, who undertakes the fool's errand of ridiculing Pharaoh's folly, Tourget warns that the palace built with these ill-made bricks will eventually collapse. The rest of the novel illustrates how the nation has imperiled its own safety by condemning the slaves it has emancipated at such great cost to make bricks without straw. Tourget knew that the story he wished to tell demanded a new type of novel, as perfectly adapted to impelling the Northern public to complete the work of Reconstruction, as Uncle Tom's Cabin had been to inspiring its antebellum readers to fight against slavery. Stowe had wrought her magic, he believed, by painting a slavery which the free man could understand and appreciate, and by embodying it in characters familiar to the Northern mind because they were essentially New Englanders or blacked Yankees. By this very means, however, Uncle Tom's Cabin had fostered the illusion that white and black Southerners would easily reach an accommodation akin to that of Stowe's benevolent masters and lovable slaves. 15 years of turmoil had disabused Northerners of this comforting illusion, but without enlightening them as to either the true causes of the South's endemic violence or the elements of a long-term solution. Hence, most had supported the federal government's rapid retreat from Reconstruction. to awaken the northern public from its slumber and summon it back to the unfinished task of liberating African Americans from white domination, Tourget created a novel that combined the prime attribute of Uncle Tom's Cabin, its power to touch the universal heart, with the social realism it conspicuously lacked. Through realism, Bricks Without Straw corrects readers' misconceptions and equips them for promoting effective policies in the South. Tourget replaces Stowe's saintly Uncle Tom and comical Topsy with three-dimensional black characters endeavoring to forge new lives for themselves. He shows them interacting primarily not with whites, but with each other, and he traces the development of the free, self-dependent African-American community. Tourget's realism illuminates the world of Southern whites as well. Bricks Without Straw reveals the complexity of Southern society, provides glimpses of the relations between poor whites and blacks, and probes the psychology of the former slaveholders. Realism does not in itself arouse readers to action, however, as Tourget's running quarrel with its literary proponents indicates that he discerned. He therefore infuses the emotional appeal of Uncle Tom's Cabin into Bricks Without Straw. Through a narrator appalled by the nation's moral torpor, he strives to ignite in his readers the same fervor Stowe had sparked in hers. Stowe's readers had gone to war to free the slaves. Tourget wanted his readers to fulfill the war's promise by rededicating themselves to the forsaken goal of Reconstruction. Tourget carefully crafted the narrative strategies, characters, and plot of Bricks Without Straw to challenge the stereotypes that white supremacists had disseminated of Reconstruction as an era of rampant Negro domination, and to present an alternative history of the brief interlude during which African Americans in the South had sought to exercise the rights the U.S. Congress had extended to them in the 13th, 14th, and 15th constitutional amendments, awarding them freedom, citizenship, and, for men, qualified suffrage. The novel proper opens with a fictional device that mirrors the legislative process of giving black men a voice in determining their own and the country's future. A chapter-long monologue in which the main protagonist, Nimbus, ponders the strange queries which freedom had so recently propounded to him and his race. "I'm dawd ding now if I know who I be anyhow," exclaims Nimbus as he reflects on the changes of identity he has undergone over the past few years and recalls how each step of his journey from slavery to citizenship has been marked by white authorities forcing him to adopt an unwanted second name. Tourget makes clear that Nimbus equates naming with establishing an identity, and that he regards defining his identity for himself as the essence of freedom. Like Malcolm X a century later, Nimbus refuses to let white society brand him or his children with the slave mark of his master's surname. Tourget's description of Nimbus systematically reverses both the falsifications of racist ideology and the cliches of minstrelsy. Unlike the burnt cork stage Negro, emphasizes Tourget, Nimbus is no comic figure. Earnest, thoughtful, and quiet, he does not shuffle or jump Jim Crow, but holds himself manfully erect. His head is not ape-like as caricatured in pro-slavery textbooks, but shapely and well-balanced. His self-reliant character gives the lie to claims that the Negro cannot manage without white supervision, while discrediting the stereotypes that have come to represent the Negro to the unfamiliar mind. Tourget simultaneously draws attention to the racializing process that the white mind goes through on seeing a human being in a black skin. Unable to recognize a fine figure of a man in ebon hue, Tourget implies, the white mind automatically perceives the same traits differently under a different racial exterior, even resorting to a different vocabulary to register its impressions. Tourget pointedly notes, for example, that if Nimbus had been white, his face would have been perceived as grave, but that because he is black, the appropriate word is heavy. Similarly, the very person who, in a white skin, would have been considered a man of great physical power and endurance metamorphoses into a savage brute in the white imagination once the skin color changes to black. Tourget specifically dispels the image of the black man as a savage brute, a major ingredient of the white supremacist campaign against Reconstruction, in a scene that shows Nimbus demanding his rights and shielding himself against violence, but not retaliating in kind when his former master, Potus Tastem Desmet, brandishes a cane over his head. "I've been a soldier since I was a slave, and there don't no man hit me a lick just because I'm black anymore," warns Nimbus as he parries the blow and wrests away the cane. Loath to harm an old man, he leaves Desmet on the ground where he had fallen or been thrown in the tussle, an ambiguity that heightens Nimbus's self-restraint, and decides to lodge a complaint and let the law take its course. "It is not the freed blacks who violate the rule of law," Tourget indicates, contrary to white supremacist propaganda, "but their disgruntled erstwhile masters." Along with the stereotype of the lawless black savage, Tourget counters allegations that Reconstruction had delivered the reins of government to ignorant ex-slaves who launched a carnival of misrule. Accordingly, he depicts Nimbus as unwilling to run for office on the grounds that he ain't got no learning and understands tobacco cultivation better than governance. Rather than aspiring to rule over whites, Nimbus acts as a leader of the black community. Tourget meticulously delineates the factors that have gained Nimbus his leadership: service in the Union Army, which has taught him to stand his ground even against a white man, a crucial lesson of liberty; investment of his military bounty money in land, through which he has acquired economic independence; skill and hard work, which have helped him to prosper as a tobacco farmer; community spirit, which he has demonstrated by donating a portion of his land and timber to establish a church and school for the freed people, and by selling small parcels of his plantation to freedmen anxious to follow his example of home ownership and self-employment; and willingness to defend the rights of his fellow freedmen at great risk to his own safety, which encourages them to do likewise. In short, Tourget characterizes Nimbus as a born leader whose illiteracy does not prevent him from exerting a beneficial influence over his peers, but does give him a sense of his limitations. Tourget had worked with many black men like Nimbus during his stints as a Civil War soldier and Reconstruction politician and judge, fugitive slaves in Union Army camps, one of whom he had actually hired and renamed Nimbus, and some of whom enlisted as soldiers. Members of the Interracial Union League chapter Tourget had joined soon after arriving in Greensboro. Organizers like Wyatt Outlaw, whose lynching he had dramatized in A Fool's Errand. His Greensboro neighbor, Harmon Unthank, the uncontested boss of the local black community with whom he had cooperated during two electoral campaigns in 1868. And the 15 African-American delegates alongside whom he had served in North Carolina's 1868 Constitutional Convention. This exposure to a broad range of African Americans in military and political settings is what enabled Tourget to sketch Nimbus so much more realistically than authors who had known blacks primarily as menials. Though Nimbus is the most memorable of the African American protagonists in Bricks Without Straw, or for that matter, in Tourget's entire corpus, the treatment of Nimbus's childhood friend and fellow community leader Eliab Hill also challenges stereotype. Tourget depicts Eliab like Nimbus with a broad, full forehead and a finely poised head rather than the misshapen cranium imputed to the Negro in pro-slavery textbooks. He gives him a directness of gaze that suggests pride in his identity rather than any sense of inferiority to whites. And once again, countering the image of the Negro as a perpetual child, incapable of providing for his own needs, Tourget accentuates the self-helping character Eliab shares with Nimbus, which he exhibits by earning his living as a shoemaker despite his severely crippled condition, the result of a rheumatic fever contracted at age 7. Eliab represents an alternative route to African-American empowerment, the acquisition of literacy that historically complemented or substituted for the economic advancement Nimbus has attained through land ownership. Taught to read by his indulgent mistress, he has exerted a magnetic influence over his community as a preacher ever since his days as a slave. In that role, Eliab personifies what Turgé calls the inseparable fusion of religion and politics among African Americans, whose religion is tinged with political thought and their political thought shaped by religious conviction. Eliab's Christianity, unlike that of Stowe's Uncle Tom, does not call for turning the other cheek. Thus, he reacts to a Klan incursion by wishing he had a good repeating rifle so that he might not only sell his life dearly, but even repel the attack. Turgé also rejects the white conventions of his time in eschewing the racial theorizing his contemporaries habitually applied to mulattoes. While describing Eliab as almost white, he does not attribute the preacher's erect, manly carriage, thoughtful brow, and nobility of expression to his white blood, or his stunted physique to the taint of black blood or the ill effects of miscegenation. The physical contrast Turgé draws between the light-skinned Eliab and his comrade Nimbus, whose complexion is black as a thundercloud, serves neither to establish a hierarchy of color nor to bolster fallacies linking behavior to blood quantum, but conveys the image of an African-American community reliant for survival on the solidarity of mulatto and black, literate and illiterate, needy and prosperous. Quote, "The colored people must stand or fall together," preaches Eliab. His lifelong bond with Nimbus and the twin leadership roles the two play illustrate that message. The theme of racial unity differentiates Bricks Without Straw strikingly from such white-authored classics as Uncle Tom's Cabin and Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. Unlike Stowe and Twain, Turgé emphasizes his African-American characters' relations with each other instead of with whites, roots his black and mulatto protagonists firmly in the African-American community, and centers his novel on the collective fate of the African-American people. Turgé's departures from the white conventions of his time stand out even in the case of the one character in Bricks Without Straw who acts the part of a jester or minstrel, Barry Lawson, the cousin of Nimbus's wife, Lugena. Unlike such minstrel figures as Twain's Jim in Huckleberry Finn, Barry does not entertain the white reader with self-important posturing, malapropisms, superstitions, or slapstick as the butt of a white character's practical jokes. Instead, he entertains his fellow blacks by laughing to keep from crying over their white bosses' countless ways of cheating and exploiting them, a typical form of African-American humor. "When I went to work sharecropping there, I didn't have a rag to my back, nary a rag. And now see just how I's covered with them," Barry jokes to roars of wry amusement. Just as Turgé fashions his characters to counter the prevalent stereotypes of African-Americans, he devises his plot to rewrite the history of Reconstruction. Rather than an orgy of misgovernment by black buffoons, he shows, Reconstruction can best be understood as a thwarted quest for self-determination. The first third of the novel highlights the freed people's progress toward economic self-sufficiency and political autonomy. The second third dramatizes their spirited resistance to the tactics white supremacists use to regain hegemony. And the last third describes their relapse into semi-slavery once their resistance is crushed. The initial phase of the action begins in 1867, but flashes back to the decades before the war and retraces the milestones on the road African Americans have traveled from slavery to citizenship. For Nimbus, who recapitulates his people's odyssey, the first of these milestones is his escape from Confederate Army lines, where he has been sent to work on fortifications, to the Union Army encampment, where he enlists in the war for his people's freedom. Much as W.E.B. Du Bois would later characterize the slave's withdrawal and bestowal of his labor as a general strike that decided the war, and would credit black soldiers with making the slaveholders face the alternative of surrendering to the North or to the Negroes, Turgé underscores that, quote, "the South fell, stricken at last most fatally by the dark hands which she had manacled, and overcome by their aid whose manhood she had refused to acknowledge," end quote. Turgé hails the second milestone Nimbus passes, the registration of his marriage after he returns home from the war, as the first act of freedom, the first step of legal recognition or manly responsibility. Once again, exemplifying Tourget's acuity as a historian, the understanding he reveals of this act of self-affirmation anticipates Herbert Gutman's groundbreaking analysis of North Carolina and Mississippi marriage registration records as proof of the ex-slave's commitment to legal marriage. In Tourget's words, the race felt its importance, as did no one else at the time. By hundreds and thousands, they crowded the places appointed to accept the honor offered to their posterity, and thereby unwittingly conferred undying honor upon themselves. To clarify the significance of the third milestone Nimbus crosses, his appeal to a Freedmen's Bureau officer to settle a dispute over wages owed his wife by her employer, their former master, Potestas Desmet, Tourget must rehabilitate the reputation of the government agency so maligned by Southern whites. The planters wanted a labor force that they could exploit and abuse at will. In their view, the Freedmen's Bureau indulged the native laziness of a race that needed to be driven to work with the lash and kept to the grindstone with draconian laws. North Carolina's conservative governor, Jonathan Worth, expressed this opinion succinctly. The race never did work voluntarily and never will, but with the Freedmen's Bureau here, the necessary discipline cannot be used. Well before Reconstruction ended, Southern planters had won their propaganda war against the Freedmen's Bureau, which was divested of its labor regulating function in 1869 and dismantled in 1872. As Tourget observes, the credulous Northern public believed the Freedmen's Bureau was a terrible engine of oppression and terror and infamy because of the denunciations which the former slave owners heaped upon it. He refutes this misrepresentation both by stressing that neither the freedmen themselves, nor white unionists, nor the teachers of colored schools joined in the torrent of detraction, and by giving readers a glimpse of a bureau officer mediating a typical dispute. In his rendition of the scene, Tourget accentuates Nimbus's moderation, the bureau officer's low-key handling of the matter, and the ex-slaveholder's wounded pride, which led him to translate a minor altercation into the most degrading ordeal he could by any possibility be called upon to pass through, because it put a gentleman on the same level as a Negro. The real reason for the planter class's hostility to the Freedmen's Bureau, Tourget indicates, is that by providing a mechanism through which laborers could seek redress for mistreatment, the agency schooled ex-slaves in the exercise of their rights as citizens, entitled to equal protection of the law. The mediation of the Freedmen's Bureau also helps Nimbus fulfill his dream of purchasing land, the fourth milestone he reaches. His development into one of the most successful tobacco farmers in the county contradicts the propaganda of planters like Worth, who must surely have known as well as Tourget did that tobacco cultivation required intensive year-round labor and that mastering the cultivation of the fine tobacco for which the locality was already celebrated took years of experience. Nimbus's example, replicated by the growth around him of a black community made up of thrifty artisans and farmers to whom he has sold parcels of his land, likewise paints a picture of black Reconstruction that Du Bois would amplify half a century later. These black folk wanted two things, Du Bois would write. First, land which they could own and work for their own crops, giving them economic freedom. And second, schools, which could satisfy their thirst for knowledge and open the doorway to political power. The school and church Nimbus builds on his land, as at Eliab's suggestion, with the assistance of the Freedmen's Bureau, which additionally supplies a Yankee school teacher, constitute a fifth milestone for the community. The last milestone on the road from slavery to freedom to citizenship was gaining the right to vote, the crowning legislative achievement of Reconstruction, introduced in the 1867 Reconstruction Act and written into the US Constitution in the 15th Amendment of 1870. Chapter 19, The Shadow of the Flag, climaxes Tourget's celebration of Black Reconstruction's successes as the colored voters of the vicinity under Nimbus's leadership meet at the church on the morning of election and march in a body to the polls with music and banners in order most appropriately and significantly to commemorate their first exercise of the electoral privilege. This chapter also marks the transition to the next phase of the novel, which focuses on the conflict between the African-American community and white supremacists. Paralleling incidents that occurred all over the South, well-armed whites block access to the polls, shoot into the procession, and almost precipitate a bloody clash. With the aborted celebration of black suffrage, Tourjée's revisionist history of Reconstruction moves from chronicling the ex-slaves' accomplishments since their emancipation to dramatizing the harassment, economic coercion, electoral fraud, and sheer terrorism through which white supremacists recaptured power, reversed black gains, and drove the freed people back into quasi-slavery. As in A Fool's Errand, Tourjée contests the era's dominant explanation of why Reconstruction failed. The blame should fall not on the ex-slaves, carpetbaggers, and scalawags scapegoated by white Southern propagandists, he argues in Bricks Without Straw, but on the nation, which refuses to protect the ex-slaves it has enfranchised, yet expects them to uplift themselves in the face of unremitting opposition from an unscrupulous, aggressive, turbulent, arrogant, and scornful ruling class. While lashing out against the national government and exposing the viciousness of the white supremacist onslaught, Tourjée nonetheless highlights the black community's valiant resistance. When the freed people are confronted with threats of retaliation for their political activities, Nimbus and Eliab lead a mass meeting at which Nimbus advocates a general strike and vows to underwrite the striking plantation workers until their white employers back down. And Eliab urges, quote, every man to do his duty and vote and act as a citizen whenever called upon to do so for the sake of his race in the future, end quote. The two also organized the black community for self-defense after being sent a coffin board painted with a skull and crossbones and the letters KKK. Even at the height of the Klan attack in which the white supremacist juggernaut culminates, Tourjée shows his black characters fighting back. Although the masked Knight Riders succeed in brutalizing Nimbus's wife, Lugena, bludgeoning the helpless Eliab almost to death, and burning down the church and schoolhouse that served as the institutional vehicles of the freed people's uplift, they do not escape unscathed. Nimbus dispatches a Klansman with his army saber swung by a practiced hand. Barry, who had earlier contended that it would be futile to fight against insurmountable odds, drives off the invaders with the fierce, angry challenge of his rifle. Most memorably, Lugena, seeing a Klansman aim a pistol at Nimbus, seizes an axe and brings it crashing down through mask and flesh and bone, cleaving the head of their foe. Despite the bravery and resourcefulness with which Tourjée credits his African-American characters, he cannot sustain his vision of an auto-centered black community. After the Klan attack, which ushers in the third and last phase of the novel, the black protagonists lose their agency and white rescuers come to dominate the action. Perhaps Tourjée sought to spur his white readers to discharge their responsibility toward the freed people they had so shamefully abandoned, an explanation in keeping with his having timed the publication of Bricks Without Straw to intervene in the 1880 election. Or perhaps he could no longer conceive of how the defeated freed people could help themselves in an era of unbridled white supremacy. In either case, through the device of letting his black characters tell their stories to sympathetic whites, Tourjée gives them a voice in exposing the realities of the unreconstructed South, if not in shaping the nation's future. Nimbus bitterly recognizes that abstract rights mean nothing unless enforced, or as he puts it, that the right to do a thing and the doing on it is two mighty different things when it's a colored man as does it. He doggedly keeps on fighting as he flees from one southern state to another, yet Nimbus's resistance only lands him in jail and subjects him to a new form of enslavement. Fined for striking back at a white boss, he's auctioned off to pay the fine and repeatedly caught when he tries to escape. He resurfaces many years later, completely broken, with the look of furtive wildness which characterizes the man long hunted by his enemies. The intrepid defiance that served Nimbus so well during the Civil War and the early phase of Reconstruction, Tourjée indicates, turns into a dangerous liability under the draconian regime that has replaced slavery. Admitting defeat more readily than her husband, Lugena concludes that tain't no use to stand up to white supremacists because they'll have their will, first or last. Metamorphosing with disconcerting suddenness into an abject dependent who kisses the hem of her benefactor, she entreats the schoolteacher Molly Ainslie to take her and her children to safety before the clan avenges the man she has axed. Only through Molly does Lugena fulfill Nimbus's dream of land ownership, this time in Kansas, where thousands of desperate freed people were embarking on a mass exodus as Tourjée was completing Bricks Without Straw. Barry, whose family Molly has also rescued, makes his own way to Kansas after struggling in vain to escape from the cycle of debt in which sharecropping traps his class. No matter what he tries, or how hard he works, he remarks with his usual pointed humor, he falls afoul of tactics the planters have invented to keep him down. A system of overcharging sharecroppers for supplies advanced on credit. A Landlord and Tenant Act, which gives the landlord the power to seize the whole crop at his discretion. A sunset law that forces tenants to sell their crops only to the landlord, rather than seeking the best price for their produce. Barry even sees election commissioners disposing of excess ballots and decides that it is no use risking his life to vote if the outcome is predetermined. Of the African-American protagonists, Eliab alone grows more self-reliant. Nursed back to health and spirited off to college in the North by his former master, Heston Lemoyne, Eliab illustrates Tourjée's belief that education will accomplish in the long run the racial uplift that Reconstruction failed to secure by legislative means. In a letter to Molly, Eliab also articulates Tourjée's view that African Americans must not only free themselves through the attainment of knowledge and the power which that gives, but strive to overcome the prejudice slavery has created in the hearts of the white people. Eliab himself exemplifies the empowerment education confers and expresses the insights of a teacher who has shared his students' travails and who consequently understands their needs better than any outsider can. Still, he realizes that faced with such a monumental task and with so little prospect of regaining their stolen rights, all too many of his fellow freed people have sunk back into the dull, plodding hopelessness of the old slave time. Unwilling to invent a utopian solution to the problem of a thwarted black reconstruction, and not yet able to foresee a time when African-American intellectuals would meet to debate solutions of their own to the race's continuing oppression, Tourjée reorients his plot from the quest for black self-determination toward the goal of unifying Northern and Southern whites around a common agenda of national regeneration. Thus, he arranges a marriage between Molly Ainslie and Heston Lemoyne, who embraces her ideals. By rebuilding the schoolhouse burned down by the Klan, hiring Eliab to take charge of it, and helping Molly watch over the freed people she has repatriated to Kansas, Heston demonstrates that genuine reconciliation between North and South entails a joint commitment to equal justice for African Americans. Tourjée nevertheless seems aware that such fictional formulas cannot bear the weight of suggesting alternative scenarios to the quasi-reenslavement of Southern blacks by an intransigent white supremacist ruling class. Deliberately undercutting these formulas, he leaves his characters at an impasse and his plot at loose ends. In the last two chapters, What Shall the End Be and How?, Tourjée abandons narrative for polemic. Speaking through Heston and addressing Northern politicians through the aptly named Congressman Washington Goodspeed, he pleads for the measure he has come to consider the only remedy for the nation's ills, a federal education bill that circumvents state control and racial inequity, as well as conflict over integration, by donating funds directly to Southern schools and tying the amounts to need and good management. The novel's inconclusive ending disturbed even Tourjée's otherwise enthusiastic publishers. complaining that it seemed crude and unfinished because the story was not completed, and the conversation between Hesden and Goodspeed simply stopped short, they inserted a sentence to provide a sense of closure. Tourget's insistence on retaining the rough-hewn aspect of his final scene confirms that he intended to deny his readers the gratification of their desire for a fictive closure at odds with historical reality. Modern readers accustomed to experimentation with literary form can better appreciate Tourget's unresolved ending and subversion of fictional formulas. Compared with the farcical chapters climaxing Huckleberry Finn, for example, in which Tom Sawyer undertakes to set a free nigger free by subjecting Jim to ordeals that almost culminate in his lynching, the unsettling denouement of Bricks Without Straw works far more effectively to refocus readers' attention on the plight of African Americans in the post-Reconstruction South, the purpose some critics see in Huckleberry Finn's much-discussed evasion. Reading and teaching Bricks Without Straw alongside classics like Huckleberry Finn and Uncle Tom's Cabin will eventually win Tourget's powerful novel the reputation it deserves as one of American literature's best works of social protest, political critique, and race fiction. Quote, about the Negro as a man, with hopes, fears, and aspirations like other men, our literature is very nearly silent. Yet the life of the Negro as a slave, freedman, and racial outcast offers undoubtedly the richest mine of romantic material that is open to the English-speaking novelist, Tourget would note in a much-quoted essay, The South as a Field for Fiction. While looking forward to the day when the children of slaves themselves would advance American literature to the very front rank by exploiting that mine, he pointed the way in Bricks Without Straw. His portrayal of African Americans as political agents is unprecedented for a white author of his time and has seldom been matched since. Even more valuable are the insights Tourget offers into a historical period that still shapes our political realities more than a century later, the Solid South. His eyewitness account of how a revolution that promised so much was suppressed, his chilling picture of terrorist violence against African Americans condoned, of civil rights abrogated, of constitutional amendments subverted, of electoral fraud institutionalized, and his scathing indictment of an American public too apathetic and gullible to challenge the propaganda that rationalized such outrages remain eerily relevant today. Bricks Without Straw at first sold even faster than A Fool's Errand had. Reviewers praised the book for its caustic irony reminiscent of Swift's, its strongly drawn characters, especially Nimbus and Eliab, its thrilling plot, its vivid picture of a representative black man's unequal contest with circumstances, its truthful delineation of Southern society, and its fair-minded criticism of both sections. The South, for the methods by which it has regained political control, the North, for the pusillanimity by which the fruits of the war have been lost. Reviewers also quoted long extracts from the passages they pronounced most striking. Nimbus's opening soliloquy, his argument with the clerk trying to register him with his master's surname, the scenes describing the black community's reactions to Klan terrorism, and Tourget's analysis of Southern psychology. They particularly commended Tourget for prescribing a remedy for the disease he had diagnosed, namely education. Not even those who objected to the author's blatant political sympathies could afford to disregard his suggestive and incisive treatment of a subject in which the whole country is profoundly interested, concluded Harper's New Monthly Magazine. Pervading all the reviews, however, was a sense that the mistakes of a botched Reconstruction could not be undone, a resigned acceptance of the status quo that boded ill for the commitment Tourget hoped to inspire to a massive federal education program for the South. The review that most ominously reflected the national mood was the Atlantic Monthly's. Once a bastion of abolitionism, this journal had so thoroughly imbibed the stereotypes Tourget was vainly attempting to dislodge that its editor reproached him with having produced an incomplete picture of history by omitting them. Despite these auguries of the marginalization Tourget would shortly meet with, for the moment, Bricks Without Straw and A Fool's Errand helped decide the 1880 election and won him more influence over the leaders of the Republican Party than he had ever exerted, even in his heyday as a radical politician and judge. Both the party's platform and the inaugural address of Republican President-elect James G. Garfield, whom he had known as in his childhood in the Western Reserve, echoed Tourget's call for a nationally funded public education system to stamp out illiteracy in the South. Clearly, Tourget had intervened in national politics at a pivotal moment when a sizable segment of the Republican camp had come to recognize the bankruptcy of President Hayes' let alone policy and still hoped to rectify it. But Garfield's assassination 4 months later brutally ended Tourget's fleeting access to political power, as well as the revival of the party's progressive wing. Tourget would spend the rest of his life championing African-American rights in novels, articles, lectures, speeches, and letters to a total of 6 different presidents. An increasingly lonely voice in the wilderness of white America, he would attract an immense black following in the late 1880s and 1890s after he launched the column of Bystanders' Notes in the Chicago Daily Inter-Ocean, a progressive Republican newspaper. Widely reprinted in the black press, Tourget's bystander column publicized the terrorism to which African Americans were still being subjected, berated the Republican Party for ignoring the fraud and violence used to disfranchise African American voters throughout the South, attacked Jim Crow, and denounced lynching, denying that it was provoked by black men's rapes of white women, and arguing rather that it served to cow blacks into abject submission. Tourget's standing in the African American community reached its height when he founded an interracial civil rights organization in 1891, anticipating the NAACP, and challenged segregation pro bono as the lawyer for the African American plaintiff in what became the Plessy v. Ferguson case of 1896. The African American luminaries who paid moving tributes to Tourget as a friend whose faith never wavered, whose courage never failed, and whose loyalty was free from a shadow of a turning to his dying day, included Ida B. Wells, and that quotation is from her, Charles W. Chestnut, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Anna Julia Cooper. Cooper best summed up what Tourget meant to African Americans, quote, "In presenting truth from the colored American standpoint, he excels in fervency and frequency of utterance any living writer, white or colored, and speaks with all the eloquence and passion of the aggrieved party himself," end quote. Yet African American accolades could not keep Tourget's memory alive during the long reign of white supremacy. Indeed, nothing more starkly epitomized the triumph of the racist propaganda machine that Tourget had fought so tenaciously than the bestseller status he lived to see attained by Thomas Dixon's The Leopard Spots, 1902, and The Klansman, 1905, the year of his death, which far eclipsed the commercial success and political influence of A Fool's Errand and Bricks Without Straw. Not until Brown v. Board of Education marked the emergence of the modern civil rights movement and the turn of the tide against white supremacist ideology did scholars rediscover Tourget's writings. And not until the rollback of civil rights and affirmative action in our own era, so much like the backlash that nullified the achievements of Reconstruction, did the Tourget revival really take off, as if we needed to live through an experience akin to his before we could properly value this great prophet's legacy. Standing as we do today on the eve of an historic election in which our generation, like Tourget's, must choose whether to vote for the future or the past, for an equal partnership of all races or a continuation of white hegemony, we can at last glimpse the harbinger of what Tourget's heroic struggle did so much to create, a truly reconstructed America. And let's hope the election results confirm this.